It's predominantly women in management roles that are creating more equitable positions in their workplace. It is not these fucking billionaires. They're not doing it.
Hello, greetings, and welcome to The Feminist Present, the podcast where we use the gift of feminism to figure out what's going on right now. I am Laura Good.
And I am Adrian Daub.
And this is the last time you're going to hear Adrian, because he was today, this, I can't remember which, this was the meeting day, not the child care crisis day. I mean, but I think it's worth narrating that these are the things that limb our time. We exist in real life.
We had to reschedule this conversation.
Totally.
There was a question of how to best accommodate the guest. And yeah, this is not my day job. And so I kind of had to,
we're all
there was like a room of seven people waiting for me to run the meeting. I was like, Probably can't
duck out on this one. Yeah.
But I'm really, real bummed to miss it. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the conversation?
I would love to. And like, I miss having you there, but I also celebrate that we exist in the muck of the real, you know, life just fluctuates like that. Samantha is an old friend of mine. We have a mutual bestie who we shout out in the conversation. And she's just someone whose feminist work as a writer and as an activist I've admired for as long as I can remember. I first came to know about her work through the blog Feministing, which we also mention.
Yes.
Which has so much DNA of in so much of the feminist writing that we engage in today. I remember just scrolling through that blog for so many hours when I was supposed to be working. She has had so many jobs and is such an interesting exemplar of like what a media career can look like. And I would also note that Samita's really proud of like the fact that she has 2 degrees from state schools and has managed this career with that background and deserves every bit of it. And in particular, her book, The Myth of Making It, A Workplace Reckoning, deals with her time as the somewhat unlikely, in her own framing, executive editor of Teen Vogue, which is both like a magazine that started in fashion and is also like a deeply political magazine.
Yeah.
I wanted to text Samita after this interview that like, as I was working on my own book, I found myself citing a Teen Vogue article because it had very excellent labor statistics about how the Academy Awards was originally created as a engine of labor oppression. But I think that speaks to the seriousness of the work that she and her team were doing over at Teen Vogue. She eventually really burned out on that job. And I think she's incredibly candid and generous in the book about why. Like, she was one of those people who got to the pandemic and couldn't believe how much free time and rest she suddenly had, and had to take a hard look at the conditions of her life in response to that. It's a book about a media career. It's a book about pandemic epiphanies. It's a book about the death of the girl boss. It's a little bit of an autopsy of the girl boss in, yeah, I thought, a really interesting and nuanced way. I don't want to just like automatically connect it to Lean In, because that's just really obvious. But in particular, I really liked the way she reckoned through Lean In.
I thought it was a great book. And a great book for the moment. I do think that there is this kind of lag. I mean, in Bed with the Right, we talked about sort of the post girl boss kind of hangover, and like how the pandemic,
that's a good way to say it, yeah,
kind of seems to have accelerated that. And like, I think it's really sort of coming out the end of of this kind of latency period where it's like, well, gee, like these things were not configured in the way we thought they were, and now it's becoming clearer. And I think this book is really doing a great job clarifying what exactly was revealed and these models were neither liberatory nor that sustainable.
Man, were they not. I will say one way in which I missed you in this conversation was she does a really sophisticated job reckoning through like what is tech's role in all of this. Mm-hmm. And she made some really interesting connections between the sort of like growth at all costs ethos of tech and like just how bad that is for human workers and how unequal the distributions of that impact are, that like you would have been nerding out pretty hard for.
Yeah. And the way that it sort of does that for all of us, right? I mean, like, the way Zoom and Slack sort of delimit work time, like, is, I think, inextricably linked to the fact that the people who make those products themselves don't observe that distinction very readily, right?
Yes.
Like you turn every Silicon Valley is great at turning every workplace in America into a mini Silicon Valley workplace,
yes,
minus the huge salaries and right. the free green juices.
Yes,
those are actually now a thing of the past as well, aren't they?
As tech like hemorrhages 15% of its workforce, like all around us. Yeah, some of those connections Sumita was making reminded me of the ones that Gia Tolentino made in Trick Mirror, particularly in the essay Always Be Optimizing, which I love to teach.
Where is that she's the salad one?
The salad one, where she's talking about the sweet green salad at the desk and, you know, you're spending as little time as possible.
Is Sweet Green going bankrupt too?
I think so.
I thought of them. Like I thought of her essay when I was like, oh wow, this is gonna be historic. Like
Peloton has been crashing too. Oh, yeah. Which is like, who couldn't have seen that coming? That's such a perfect example of why ongoing, never-ending exponential growth at all costs is never possible. It's always circumstantial and like tailored to what people want and need at that moment. Anyway,
you should still buy our NFTs though, obviously.
Dude, I have been wondering what happened with the NFTs. Like, I just haven't heard the same chatter about them, and I wonder if everybody went bankrupt.
Yeah, that's likely. While we're hawking,
we're talking about tech, Adrian's thoughts on the tech industry.
You'll be happy to hear that the feminist president now has a Ponzi scheme all its own. No, I'm kidding.
Buy our tincture.
I have a book coming out. It's on. It's coming out September 24th. The cancel culture panic, how an American obsession went global. If you pre-order it and send me proof of pre-order, can be of any kind, at cancel.research@gmail.com, I will send you swag. Specifically, I will send you a tote bag. And a couple of bookmarks and a tote bag for the feminist present.
Because
it turns out we have a whole box of those we bought during the pandemic. I'm like,
yeah, we did. Yeah,
that was ambitious. I don't think I saw them until like a year later.
I have at least six of them. Like I use them for groceries all the time.
I see people with them around. We've gifted them to people and like I've seen them around campus. It's nice. But like
our branding,
you too can now be an owner. And if you go downstream and you want to sell like 15... We should totally MLM our tote bag business.
Yes. If you just want to build your downline, all you need is 100 bags to start. And we'll give you a free ebook about how to build your business from home. And honestly, I could have been fucking great at MLMs, just like Liz Lenz two generations ago.
I think that anyone who has pitched their writing would do a fairly okay job. I mean, as L. Ron Hubbard clearly realized, like, oh, I can use this to start a cult.
I mean, I would like, as a friend and colleague, to make a personal appeal for the reader to buy Adrian's book. This man has been out on the cancel culture, like, talking, I don't even know what to call it, like talking road
circuit.
Trip.
Yeah.
Circuit. That's the word I was looking
cancel
for.
Cancel culture circuit.
The cancel in German, in English, on multiple continents, in multiple countries. This man has been enduring Q&As on this subject for literally years. The least you can do is buy this excellent, nuanced, and sophisticated book.
For the love of all things sacred. I gotta weigh my thumbs.
I know. This man has a daughter. He's raising it. And lest you think that we will only be exhorting you to buy books by men, we would never do that. We are exhorting you to buy books by this man and many women.
And by Sumita. We should say more.
And by Sumita. Yes, exactly. Her book, The Myth of Making It, A Workplace Reckoning, is out now in stores. I believe it came out in June.
That's right.
And I loved it. You should read it. And I don't know. Let us know how you feel. Hit us on the social media. You know, we haven't done one.
Follow
of
us. Give us a like and subscribe.
Little like and subscribe for our MLM. Okay. Yeah. This is me and not Adrian talking to Sumita. Please enjoy.
Enjoy.
Sumita, where do I start? Okay. I have to do a little like meta narration. So you focus on 2009 as a particular inflection point in the book. And I believe that is the year we met. And I'm rolling back the tape and remembering who we both were in 2009. We met through this crucial friend, Neela Banerjee. Shout out to the genius that is Neela. I was working for this radical news organization with Neela and also the name check Jamila King in your book. you were finishing your master's at that point, were you not, at SFSU?
Yeah, I was. My goodness.
And tell me about that degree experience as like an on ramp to talking about the rest of this book.
Yeah, I mean, I did a master's. I think that it was like, you know, I had been a gender studies student. Like my undergrad back in the 90s was in women and gender studies, and then I had started blogging in like 2005, I think. And, you know, I think at the time, feminist blogs were just starting to make a splash a little bit. I mean, maybe
yes,
after.
I should have mentioned that.
2005.
But you talk. Yes, yes.
And so my master's was really focused on this moment of like, yeah, you know, what is happening in media and what do all these blogs mean? Which, like, I mean, how innocent we were to the role that the internet would play yes, in all of this. So yeah, I think I needed, I mean, let's be real, like I was a substitute school teacher in San Francisco. I, you know, had odds and ends jobs here and there, but like really wanted to get the space to focus on writing and blogging. And so I took out a bunch of student loans and decided to get a master's instead. And for the lucrative work of professional feminist. And so, yeah, I think in a lot of ways that set the groundwork for me to then feel comfortable and confident as like a public feminist intellectual, which,
yes,
you know, I have like tried to be for the last 15 years.
Which you absolutely observably have been. You just touched on something that I should have touched on myself, which is that when I met you, you were already a celebrity to me because you were involved with Feministing, which was such a crucial blog. And one of the things that I loved about your book, The Myth of Making It, that I want to talk about is how much it chronicles like the mainstreaming of feminism, period. Mm. But how it chronicles that arc beginning in a place that we grew up in of feminism not being trendy, feminism not being discussable or popular. You know, when I met you, I was like, oh, here's another woman who has brought up the feminist point in every class that she's been in. Like, I relate to her. And I also, I know that that experience can be really lonely. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about like the soup that we grew up in yeah, like late Gen X and millennial, and how that informs this book?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I will say that my feminism, I was very blessed because my feminism was kind of born of community to an extent, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm, I, while I did feel alienated in my opinions, often like in my family or in like broader communities, feminism was brought to me because I was like interested in the underground, like in mm-hmm, Riot Girl and mm-hmm, hip hop and like all the cool stuff that was happening in the late 90s and the arts and, you know, conscious hip hop. And so I kind of, you know, I was an activist really early. Like I was a student activist. You know, I was arrested multiple times before the turn of the century. And so I actually like feel like I was very lucky in that like feminism was very real for me. It wasn't like a intellectual endeavor. It was really like a lived experience that I then was mentored by all of these amazing people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you think about that moment, it's like, there are so many things today that we just assume are taken for granted, right? Like intersectionality, body positivity, right? Fat acceptance, like all of this language, like my, you know, that you will hear young people be like, you're fat shaming me. And you're like, like, where did you hear that? You know,
I'll just narrate Samitha and I like waving our hands frantically in that moment. Yes.
You
yes.
Know? So I think that that, you know, that, you know, I think people don't realize like what we were working with.
Exactly.
Then, and like how groundbreaking work like Feministing was at the time, if I do say so myself. But
it was, yes. Call it
know,
out.
It was not like Feministing came out at a time when, you know, if we recall, Time Magazine was basically like, you know, Gen X feminists are just thong wearing sex freaks and we were, and also yes.
designing and, our own clothes at Burning Man. Yeah,
no, literally. And
I know.
And, you know, and we were, and that feminism was dead and, you know, all of that. And older feminists were saying that about us.
Yes.
Too, right. So
yes.
It's like there was no, and you see that happening again, right? It happened generation after generation, you know, where we like shame younger women for, you know, their way that they're espousing these politics. So I think, yeah, I think when you think about the evolution of even the fact that it's totally normal now for a paper to talk about race, class, and gender, in 2008, when Hillary and Barack were running against each other, all of these newspapers were like, wait, how do we cover these issues? We don't care about it. And, you know, and I think a lot of ways that led to the historical moment that, like, I was able to navigate, which, like, you know, starting at Feministing and indie media, and then ending up at Teen Vogue, which is this, like, super mainstream platform, because in that, you know, 10, 15 years, that's how much it became essential to how we understand media and how we understand how we talk about these issues.
Yes, exactly. And your trajectory, as you note, is such a handy analog for that. Okay, so we survive Hillary and Barack. I love just referring to them by their first names. That feels totally right to me. Like, and we get into the 2010s. Like, you reckon with the girl boss in such an interesting and nuanced way. And I just want to, like, narrate for the reader. It doesn't seem like you are interested in throwing out the baby with the bathwater. You're so good at detailing what was important about the girl boss, you know, like what elements of her helped mainstream the conversation and push the discussion forward, and then what ended up being really problematic. Like, please, Samhita, speak on the girl boss.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think that when I started writing this book, we were kind of part of the motivation for writing the book was we were coming off of the, like, great girl boss cancellations of 2020,
yes.
Right? We had, you know, the pandemic happened, and then there were the George Floyd protests. And then you have this moment where all of these, you know, employees are coming forward and they're talking about inequality in the workplace. And it became this, like, cottage industry beat, right? Of, like, okay, where's the next toxic, you know, white woman, lady boss, and, like, how do we take her down? And we were, like, chomping at the bit for these stories.
Totally.
And, you know, and I think that, you know, I obviously am always going to be on the side of labor. And I think that unequal, unfair working conditions always need to be held accountable and need to be called into account. But the eagerness with which we were relishing the downfall of these girl bosses felt a little too on the nose. Like, I was like, you know, and it's similar to actually what's happening with Tradwives right now. Like, the kind of, you know, the media, and I hate to say that because I know it's, like, so many different things and you want to be specific.
Including, like, us. Yeah.
Yeah. But we fixate a lot on examples that show that feminism is dead. And the response is to say, like, well, we tried to give you all money. We tried to invest in your businesses. We tried, you know, it's like feminism and capitalism just doesn't exist. And then rather than offer a solution, we tear it down, or we say, this is the lesson. Like, basically we, you know, fixate on this stuff because, like, rather than fixating on the fact that, you know, that a lot of women maybe fantasize about trad wife life because they can't fund their businesses,
yes,
or because, like, they have, you know, ambitions that they can't express in these patriarchal relationships. So rather than focus on that, we focus on the choices that these individual women make.
Right.
But that's a derail. So where I get into with the girl boss is really looking at what it tells us about the, you know, contentious relationship between feminism and capitalism, but that the lesson shouldn't just be that, like, women shouldn't be leaders. Because at the end of the day, this system is not, like, as much as I appreciate the, like, tear it down sentiment, I'm a little bit more pragmatic than that. And
yes,
the reality,
yes,
is, like, after working at Teen Vogue and working with a lot of young people, they were very seduced by the kind of girl boss narrative. They hadn't necessarily followed the takedowns. The ones that had were, like, kind of conscientious about it, but they didn't, it didn't change them from being ambitious or wanting to start businesses, mm-hmm, or wanting to kind of, quote, girl boss their life. So I think, you know, I wanted to kind of situate it within how there's a very limited way that we can understand success and understand women's ambition. And the girl boss was one of them. It was imperfect. It was not, you know, there was many things to criticize about it, but those things are, we could criticize that about every kind of business. Like, it's not just women-led businesses.
Yes.
And that's really what I wanted to point out and say, like, a lot of this is a function of capitalism. I mean, but why are we focusing on the founder rather than focus on the person that's giving her the $70 million or, you know, the person that's like, oh, it's a great time for women in business. Let's, like, sure, you know, whatever her name is from, the bad blood woman.
Elizabeth Holmes. Yes.
Like,
yes.
It's like, yeah, sure. Let's just give her, you know, 10 million, whatever. It's like,
yeah,
you know, it's like, that's also a function of sexism, you know?
Yes.
So I think that was kind of what I really wanted to parse out, you know, yes. in a more nuanced way that's like kind of not really possible in the binary thinking that is like the internet these days.
Exactly. And one of the things that I appreciated most about this book was how shrewd an economic thinker you are, which is definitely coming through in the comments that you've just been making. And like the pragmatism, you know, I guess, let me step back and meta-narrate for a minute here. Two things. One, I started in this job at Stanford in 2019. I remember I taught a seminar, a gender studies and English seminar called The Evolution of the Feminist First Person Essay, which was sort of about this essay boom. Really, really fun class discussion. In that first fall 2019, I remember including in my syllabus a chapter of Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, and not a single person in the class had ever encountered this text before. Mm. Fast forward to same class, fall 2020. Not only had they all read White Fragility cover to cover, all of a sudden Girl Boss had become Girl Boss Gaslight Gatekeep. And this was what every single college student was saying to me, which like, I'm here for it. Like, let's make that critique. But I appreciated the pragmatism of your book because as someone who works with college and graduate students, I'm often in the position of advising on like the first job or the sort of first career move. And so often I'm discussing these possibilities with these wonderfully feminist students who really want to find a job that's going to match their values. Mm-hmm. How possible is that going to be, Samhita, on the basis of your exploration? How possible is it going to be to find a job that matches your values?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's, you know, I think that not, it's going to be very hard to find a job that matches all of your values at the same time, every time, right? Like, I don't think that piece of it is realistic. I think it's really important to understand that like we are operating in imperfect systems, right?
Yes.
We're operating in imperfect systems and we still, you know, if you are like most of us, you have to work to pay your rent and you have to work to eat, and not every freaking moment of your career is going to be like, I am so inspired and driven by purpose. Like,
totally.
Which is not realistic. And
no.
I think that this, you know, I think this kind of fixation on quiet quitting and the great resignation and, you know, the idea that like, I'll just be lazy because like, screw them and like damn the man and like, yeah. I'm just gonna call it in and like be lazy and whatever. Mm-hmm. That's okay for a little bit of time. Like there's gonna be times in your life where you have a job that you just need to do for money or you just mm-hmm. need to do for whatever relationships you're trying to build or whatever that might be. It's okay to call it in a little bit. It's okay to check out a little bit. But the reality is we are as humans purpose driven. We need to find love. We need to find happiness in the things that we do. And you know, and balancing that with the reality that like work is likely not going to fully satisfy you there and find, you know, find that kind of what I call in the book, the margin of maneuverability, find yep. the space between yep. what feels insurmountable, capitalism, an economic system that relies on our disenfranchisement to be successful, and our reality that like we need to find something to motivate us day to day. And so yep. you know, that's everybody, like there's no employee that isn't like, God, I wish this felt a little more meaningful. Like whether they can articulate that or not, everybody feels that way. And so it's about figuring out, you know, the moments where you can. And, you know, in the book I talk about, for me, it's been like really investing in the people that work for me and accepting yes. who they are and motivating them and keeping them inspired and, you know, kind of being like a camp counselor a little bit, you know, but that's brought a lot of meaning to my life. And that's what, you know, that I've taken leadership really seriously. And that matters to me.
Leadership and mentor, sorry to interrupt you, but like, I know from like existing in the same media space that you do, that you also take mentorship really seriously. And that's part of your career ethic too. Sorry, please go on.
No, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah. And so I think, but you know, maybe for you, like that's, you know, getting to work on with young people and like mm-hmm. getting to work on these topics and hearing from them about what, you know, how they're engaging with this stuff. And I think there's always something, you know, like my partner works, you know, in food and he was like, works in media for a really long time, but now he's like, every day I get to make people happy. And like, that's what brings him a lot of joy and a lot of purpose. And so it's just figuring out, you know, like what is the thing and being honest with yourself. It's like, be real with yourself. Like, it's like, is it that you are like oppressed in the workplace or do you just not feel like doing it? And so it's like hard to work through that. Or, you know, is it like a temporary job? Like, be real with yourself. Are you more ambitious than you're acknowledging that you might be? Are there things you want that you're afraid to get? I think like all of that, like all of these self-awarenesses that I feel like we bring. And I think that there's this like, there's a real focus right now on mental health. And I think in some ways that's really good. But I also think sometimes that can be a end of a conversation, not a beginning. Like, it's like, I need a mental health day. Okay. Like, sure. Same. And like, I'm a different generation, so we didn't get those, but like, more power to you. And also, you know, why? Like, let's talk about why. Like, I don't need to be your therapist, but like, did someone actually trigger you? Did you actually experience trauma? Or did something just make you uncomfortable and you don't feel like doing it? Like, I think we need to like be honest about that.
Yes, you know?
And not just always be like, well, oh, they said mental health, we can't have any more, you know? And it's okay. Like, you know, it's like, I don't know, life is hard. Like, we are all struggling. We're all doing our best. And I think it's important to create environments where people feel like they can bring their full selves. But we also need to be honest with ourselves about, you know, where we're at on a lot of these questions. And that's something that I'd like to, like, that's something that I hope for, that like people read this book and really start to reflect on some of those personal decisions of like, you know, and then also recognizing that like, we can only individually do so much. And that's the reality. But also as an individual, are you doing enough? Are you doing enough to actually change your workplace? Or are you just complaining about it? Because I think a lot of people right now complain and they love to complain.
I mean, I loved so many of the generational notes that you made and how you use your own autobiography to illustrate this kind of projected professional trajectory and the choices and the compromises that are implicit within that. And particularly when you note like how hard it is for you to let go of hustle, you know, as someone coming from the particular context and background that you do, I don't come from exactly the same background, but I related to that so deeply. You know, I hear these college students say things like, what's my dream job? I don't dream of working. And I'm like, whoa, like my brain is like, I love you for saying that. And that is a brilliant advancement. But like, wow, that's a different paradigm than the one I have ever been allowed to exist in.
100%.
Right? And yeah. I mean, I think this would be such a use. I plan on buying this book for a lot of recent graduates because I think it would be a really handy companion to How to Build a Career. But like, what I really love in your economic timelining is how you position this like revolt against the girl drop as bringing us right up to the doorstep of the pandemic in like a historically significant way. I want to read from the text here. I'm on page 84 for the class. What has economists and social scientists marveling, though it is perhaps hardest to measure, is what Dr. Anthony Klotz, the organizational psychologist who coined the expression the Great Resignation, calls pandemic epiphanies. He argues that one reason for the high number of resignations was the backlog of people waiting for the pandemic to ease before they quit. I did. That's Samita knowing that, not me. But that alone doesn't account for the statistically high numbers of job ditchers. The reality was that many jobs became dangerous and untenable, employees suffered burnout, and many people began to feel like their only option for their health and well-being was to quit. Middle-class Americans also had a little more savings than before after spending a year at home foregoing family vacations and other living expenses that come with going outside. The pandemic was a life-changing event, and here's the thing about such events. They make you more reflective. I'm torn right now between the impulse to vomit on you my own pandemic epiphanies and to talk to you more about yours. What was the epiphany? Like, if you had a pandemic epiphany, what was it?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I realized how much my job was exhausting me and how happy I was in my life until the pandemic, because I was just going and going and going. And I physically,
as you had been programmed to do by so many forces for so many years. Yes, go on.
No, exactly. And I think that, you know, there was like a series of epiphanies that led to my decision to write this book. But I think that when I was laid off from my job in 2017, a normal person would have been like, you know what, that was a big blow to my ego and career and mental health, and I should take a break. I should
take a minute, yeah,
and figure out what I want to actually do next. And instead, I went on a book tour and I pushed through, and then I got the job at Teen Vogue. And I think that that had some consequences long term, because I didn't really deal with what had happened in that moment. I carried that baggage with me.
Grief. You didn't deal with the grief. Yes.
Grief and, you know, all of those fun things that come up, especially when you don't come for money and I, you know, and you don't have like someone to fall back on. And so, you know, all of that kind of trauma manifested in my body in really profound ways. And I did not realize that until I stopped, until everything stopped. And all of a sudden I was home and I didn't have to go to work. And I started cooking my meals. We couldn't go out anymore. I couldn't, you know, take cars anywhere. So I was walking and, you know, I was meeting people for walks 6 feet apart. I mean, it's, we're such clowns, no masks, but 6 feet apart. Those first couple of weeks were so clownish. And, you know, we're washing fruit, but not wearing masks. It was amazing. And
we didn't
you know,
we didn't know.
Yeah, no, we didn't know. It was so funny. And, you know, so I think that when that happened and I was like, why am I so happy to not be going to work? I had to kind of forced a reckoning because that was my pandemic epiphany that I like am happier in nature and I like working from home and I want to spend more time with my family and I want to spend more time on myself and my mental health. And I mean, like my entire life changed after that, you know, and I'm still struggling to kind of figure out that balance. And I think a lot of people are, and that's why I wanted to write about it because
yes,
I don't think,
yes.
Like it was wild how like every ambitious woman in my life was like relieved when the pandemic happened, except for my college roommate who's a nurse, but otherwise, you know, everyone else was like, so relieved. But wait, what is your pandemic story?
Well, I got divorced, girl.
What?
We're going to talk offline. Yeah. I mean, I had this wonderful job and two kids under age 5. And the only way I kept the job was by dispatching my 78-year-old retired mother, who's a former teacher, out to homeschool my then first grader. Such a privilege that I was even able to do that. Did it make anybody happy? No, it did not. No, it did not. And I think the pandemic for me, I mean, I love how you detail this in the book, how it felt like a snow day at first. You know, oh, we're at home. We can watch Netflix today. We don't have to commute. That was novel at first. And then the novelty slipped into Groundhog Day of day after day of a Zoom call in every room of the house between two parents and a first grade or the kindergartner then trying to do Zoom school at home, like waking nightmare. And it was just like every day was three loads of laundry and an unsustainable equation. And I think in the previous iteration of my life, I had been able to leave the house a lot and I had wonderful friends and a fulfilling job. And I returned to the island of my home and there was no nourishment there. And, wow. You know, I can't tell you how many pandemic divorces I know about. I'm sure you do too. You know, I can't tell you how many people I know who have come out as queer or trans in a more explicit way. Like this pandemic epiphany is a major feature of this era and our generation in it. So I really appreciate the language you're putting to it. It feels really important.
I appreciate that. You know, I hadn't even thought about the people coming out as queer and trans. Total aside, but somebody needs to look into that because that is such a real thing. And definitely the divorces.
Yes.
I mean, it's funny because I had been single for like 15 years and I actually met somebody like kind of towards the end of the pandemic. And so, you know, but I think because I had this big epiphany of like, you know, I work all the time. I don't take care of myself. Like similarly, like I have a wonderful group of friends, but like, what is my life without my career? And then I was like, wait, I actually want to share my life with somebody. And I yeah. want, you know, there were
it's
all
the
these
same
things
looking around and being like, there's a nourishment I need that I'm not getting that I'm going to pursue because I know this now. Yes,
exactly.
Totally.
Exactly.
I think there is some research that's emerging on the number of people who have come out. And I hope there's more. And I would also note that I think that is not unconnected to the number of divorces. particularly in the Bay Area where I live. Yeah. Here's a question I want to ask. Like, this book is both so rigorous and so heartfelt. You offer up the fluctuations of your own story in such a generous and such an illustrative way, you know? And in particular, I really like how you note a series of imperfect jobs that you had good reasons for taking all of them. You know, I love the way you detail, like, this woman really inspired me and I hadn't heard this before. And this mission really inspired me and I never thought I would be capable of going to Fashion Week or whatever, you know? But I guess as you're reading this, as you're like pulling this straight from your heart, who do you hope it goes to? Like, who is your ideal reader? Who are you hoping picks up this book?
I mean, definitely your students, definitely people
in progress,
that are, you know, figuring out these questions. I mean, I was really, I'm not like, I think that I didn't think as much about who it was going to reach as much as it was really important to me to be honest about all of that and to be really vulnerable and have that be an opportunity for people that have looked up to women like me and been like, oh, I want to do, like, what are all the things I can do to get to where you are? And it's like, well, the journey is actually really imperfect and can really scar you and can be really challenging. And so
it doesn't mean that you did anything wrong. Like, that's the subtext to what you're saying that I think is so generous and beautiful. Sorry to cut you off to yell at you about how amazing you are again. Please go on.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, I think that's, yeah, I think the, my hope is that it's hits, you know, ambitious young people. And interestingly, I've been talking to a lot of young men and non-binary people who have really resonated with the book as well. You know, and not necessarily a frame that I went into it with, not because I am exclusionary, but because I was writing so much from my own experience. And, you know, and there's also just such a lack of data around the association with gender outside of the, like, gender pay gap and things like that. So, you know, it's been an interesting where I think a lot of people are, like, I don't think, like, men are doing great at work either.
No, right. I agree.
You know? So my hope is that a lot of people read this in terms of people that feel alienated and isolated, they feel miserable, they feel very called to quiet quit, to, you know, throw ambition out, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, and rather to really think about what are more sustainable ways to express our ambition, and also what is the community piece of this? Like, how do we link up with other people to actually create a workplace that's sustainable? Because right now it's not, and I mean, businesses are going to have to catch up with it, right? But I do think this work around accountability from business leaders is so important. And I think this, like, you know, the way, the rate at which people are organizing right now, union membership, like all of that is really exciting. But it's also not universal, right? Like, not every job can be unionized. Not every, like, a lot, like, what, how does unionization help a freelancer? You know, so there's just so many ways to be thinking collectively right now. And I think people are, right? Like, yeah, I think people are in a moment of, like, collective anguish and collective action. And so
No help is coming. How are we going to help ourselves is the mood I'm reading.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love that this is connecting with men and non-binary people too. That doesn't surprise me. I mean, as we're talking about economic inflection points, as I sit here in the Bay Area right now, tech companies are hemorrhaging for, like, in a way that they haven't since, I don't know, the last bust. So it wouldn't surprise me if there are a number of people who find this material very relevant to them. I also love the way you dig into the ethos of tech companies and connect that to some of these inequities, you know, like this whole move fast, break things attitude of the late 2000s, early 2010s. I mean, it was all around me, dude. Like, this was every party I went to, this exponential growth. And everybody's looking for the 100 million venture capital dollars so they can achieve exponential growth. How is exponential growth anti-feminist?
Yeah. So I think it's not even necessarily like anti-feminist as much as it is like anti-labor.
There it is.
I think the expectation that people are expendable and that humans are an expendable resource is pretty much the biggest miscalculation that big tech has made at this point, right? That you can just cycle through people. You can just cycle through Uber drivers. You can just cycle through Airbnb owners. Like, whatever it is, like, all of these companies require an underclass of underpaid exploited labor. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what's happening. We can say it any way we want to say it. Even the way that we treat tech employees is a type of exploited labor, unless you're a founder or you're in, like, the C-suite.
Correct.
The rest of y'all are just freaking fighting for your cafeteria lunch. Okay. Like, let's just keep it 100. And so, like,
keep it above.
So, you know, and I think that, one of the things that we're seeing more than anything in this moment is this radicalization of white collar workers. Like, I think that labor has been, you know, it's been 10 years since the first fast food, like, big fast food unionization drives and
wage increase
protests. Right. And the wage increases. So I think that, you know, for working class folks, like, this has been an ongoing fight. But now people are talking about labor because white kids that went to freaking Wellesley are talking about it. You know what I mean? It's like, they're like, you're seeing unionization at every level in a company. And so I think that is very telling of how people feel disempowered in their workplace right now. Even people that make six figures are like, I'm being exploited because I am expected to work at 10 o'clock at night. Like, so what if I make six figures? Like, why should I work at 11 o'clock at night? And, you know, all of these things that labor worked so hard for us to have parameters around, and like big business came and just like chipped away at it. And it wasn't just, it's like we submitted to it, right? It was cultural norms as much as it was legal norms. And so I think that that's, you know, a big piece of this moment is really looking at how a lot of these businesses that were so focused on growing fast, growing big, growth at all costs came, the cost was people. The cost was equitable treatment of people and equality. And that's what's going to come to bite them in the ass, because these kids aren't putting up with this shit. I don't know, like, anyone who's has a team right now where they have anyone who's willing to work past like 5 p.m. Like, that's literally does not exist. Like, it's the one, and it's starting to make, like, people are starting to reflect on it. They're like, okay, maybe I shouldn't push people past their limits. But we need to see that at a much broader scale, of course. And it's predominantly women that are doing that. It's predominantly women in management roles that are creating more equitable positions in their workplace. It is not these fucking billionaires. They're not doing it.
I love that you needed like an example school of where to call out white privileged kids, and well, talking to someone who works at Stanford, you picked Wellesley. That pleased me a lot. I mean, so much of what this book is doing, like what I think this book's like sneaky mission is, or one thing that I took from its sneaky mission is you're overtly critiquing the girl boss. You're overtly critiquing these unequal systems of economics, as well you fucking should, thank God. I think your book also presents a really beautiful roadmap for what a career in media and publishing can look like at this moment in time. And you know, and I know that that is not an easy fucking career to come by. So I don't even know what question I want to ask, because it seems the book does such a good job outlining this already. But if you had to summarize it, what do you think has changed in like trying to work in media and publishing between when we were just starting out and now?
I mean, we're in a flop era.
It's not good. It's not.
Things are not good right now, right? So I think that, you know, if someone like me can't really make it as a freelance writer, I'm not really sure what that means for other freelance writers. You know, I think that the exploitation that has happened in digital media of paying people the least amount to have them churn content. And, you know, now we're like, I think the role that social media has played in challenging the notion of truth is, you know, something that's really, that plus media consolidation, I think, has led to a graveyard of digital media. Like, mm-hmm. I was even saying, you know, like, I've done a lot of podcast interviews for this book, but when my first book came out in like 2011 or 2012 or whenever it came out, I got so much press because there were so many outlets. There were so many blogs, outlets,
feminist
publications. You know, I mean, like Salon had a feminist blog. Like everyone had, you know, or there were like Feminist Thing, there were Pandagon, like there were all these, there was a robust ecosystem of women's media.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, I was still like, I am certainly not going to not be grateful for the amount of exposure that I've gotten and coverage that I've gotten. But it has definitely felt much quieter because those ecosystems don't exist in the same way anymore. You know, I mean, you don't have a lot of the outlets even 7-8 years ago that we had.
Literally.
BuzzFeed, Mike, like, yes. You know, all of these places that, you know, some of which I worked at, Teen Vogue. I mean, Teen Vogue is still there, but like they don't have a huge staff anymore. You know, like mm-hmm. all of these cutbacks have just made it that there's literally no jobs. Like every time I'm hiring for a entry-level job, people that have 15 years of experience apply. Like it is the wildest thing I've ever seen. And I keep hearing this from other editors too. They'll have like an entry-level writer job and they're like, yeah, the person who ran like X section at the Times like applied for it. And you're just like, what? Like, and that's the moment we're in. And I don't mean that to be discouraging, because I think that there it's like both of these things are true at the same time, where we have more tools than ever to express ourselves and to create platforms and to build platform, right? Like Substack, Instagram, like there's so many publishing places for us to do things free or at low cost and still be able to kind of build community, build, you know, and mm-hmm. if But like what does not exist is the startup capital to make that happen, right? That's like right. You can't just like jump onto it. Like if, you know, it's just the same system replicates itself. Like the only people that could blog full time were the ones that had husbands who paid for them. And I'm going to tell you right now, some of the most toxic people online that would be out here talking about, oh, I'm personal color, I'm this and that, they were soccer moms, like period. Okay. And so that has not changed. And so now, unless you've like built up a certain amount of audience and you know for sure you're going to get some money, or it's a crapshoot. It's a crapshoot. And there are not many writer jobs, and there just aren't. And, you know, and I think that that's a problem for democracy. It's a problem mm-hmm. for our culture, but it's also mm-hmm. a problem for aspiring writers that are looking to work in these industries. I mean, I am asked constantly what my advice is for young writers. And I'm like, find another thing to do.
I'm like become a doctor, get a medical degree. That's my advice. Yeah.
Well, I mean, or like, you know, study business models. Like we need to like innovate in the
yes.
space, right?
Yes.
Like
it's an opportunity. Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, that's, you know, but, and that sounds really negative because I also feel like, I guess I am a little bit pessimistic about the state of media right now. I unfortunately am, but I also think that people are doing really interesting and cool things, and people yeah. are thirsty for content. Like
yes.
the thing that hasn't changed is how much people want content and
God,
how much
yes.
people want fact-checked and good content. They're just not used to paying for it anymore. So that like cultural shift does leave an opportunity, but it also makes it really hard if you're trying to build a career and you're trying to sustain yourself in an yes. industry that is literally dried up.
That is so well said. I couldn't agree more. There's opportunity in like striking out on new ideas, but there's no infrastructure for them. And that's devastating. I mean, I would connect what you just said in terms of racial inequity and who get and gender inequity and who gets the opportunity or the privilege to write. Like we've just seen this glut in 2024 that I'm stoked about of divorce memoirs, right? And most of them have been by white women. I just had a fantastic interview a couple weeks ago with Sarah Manguso, who wrote Liars. I love these books. I'm not at all shitting on these books. I only want to note who has the time to write a memoir after divorce. You know, like that requires a certain kind of resource and sustainability that like, you know, is probably not going to be evenly distributed. And that's just, that's... It's not a secret. I was going to call it a dirty secret. It's like the worst kept dirty secret of media and publishing is that most people in it come from money, because that's how
100%.
Right? And like
100%.
You are a labor stan and I am here for that. And I think that there's such important dimensions of why that has become a privilege. You know, it's because we don't compensate it. Like yeah. Anyway, I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
No, absolutely.
I mean, okay, so you have 13 jobs to return to. What are you working on now? And what do you hope people check out about your work after they devour absolutely. And love The Myth of Making It, A Workplace Reckoning?
Please, yes, please read The Myth of Making It. I currently work at The Meteor, which is a feminist media company founded by the former editor-in-chief of Glamour, Cindy Levy, and we do kind of feminist content production, events, and so definitely follow us. Check us out. And I don't know, I have a lot of freelance stuff coming up. I've been like not taking my own advice this summer. I am exhausted. And like,
why am I not surprised?
Yeah, I am exhausted. So I think my friend said something very wise to me. And he was like, you know, I'm curious what the year reflection of this book coming out will be, because I do think
yeah,
putting a book out is
me too.
I have not had children, but to me, I imagine it's similar in that like,
yes.
you're a bigger mess after than you realized you would be.
kind of so gets worse before it gets better kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yes.
So
yes.
I think I'm in the post birthing
okay.
chaotic energy a little bit right now. And then I need to kind of figure out what's next and what I've learned from all of this. And so, yeah, I also have a Substack. So check that out.
What's it called? Shout it out.
It's called The Samita.
How appropriate. The book is The Myth of Making It. The author is Samita Mukhopadhyay. Everybody should read it, including my students who want to make media careers. And they're going to hear a lot about this from me.
Dude. I love it. Thank you so much.
The Feminist Present is a production of the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research. The co-hosts are Adrian Daub and Laura Good. This podcast is produced by Ana de Almeida Almiral. We are especially grateful to our feminist colleagues, Allison Bell Crossley, Jennifer Portillo, Cynthia Newberry, Leah Gottlieb, Bethany J. Nichols, Jessica Lopez, Susan Krieger, Argavon Salas, and Moira Donegan.